Welcome back. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines, and this is Manuel Criollo. So, you know, this past weekend, the Strategy Center, the Bus Riders Union, hosted a international conference at USC, the University of Southern California. It was called the Future Transportation for LA, the Nation, and the World, where we had a variety of speakers who talk about transportation equity, the dangers of global warming, the dangers of, you know, the underfunding of the bus transportation system throughout the country. And we had folks from around the country talking about the phenomenon of the highway lobby and the rail lobby taking away basically funding from Black and Latinos. But more importantly, I think one of the most important speakers that we had was Clayton Thomas Mueller, who talked to us and challenged us about the question around the supremacy of indigenous rights in the country. In other words, he sort of made a great analogy about how indigenous people and nations in many ways have become sort of our batteries to feed, you know, our hunger for more energy and for more waste. So welcome to the show, Clayton Thomas Mueller.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, my brother.
So, Clayton, talk to us about the Indigenous Environment Network, how long you've been in existence, and what's sort of the work that you do.
Well, first of all, hello to everybody that is listening. What a pleasure and an honor it is to be here today to share a few thoughts, things that I strongly believe in and the work that I'm involved in. IEN, or the Indigenous Environmental Network, was established in 1990. We were formed by community-based indigenous peoples to address environmental and economic injustice issues within our Indian homelands here in the United States and across Turtle Island, what we call North America. Now, basically what that means is what we've been doing for the last, you know, over 15 years is fighting to protect the sacred fires of our traditions from corporate exploitation, toxic contamination, because of the disproportionate targeting of our homelands for, you know, sites for toxic waste dumps or unsustainable dirty energy development and a whole long list of really critical environmental racism issues. So for 15 years, IEN has been working to support our indigenous nations across this land to do this.
You know, at the conference, like I was talking about earlier, you know, you raised some really, important questions, particularly around the question around, you know, sort of clean fuels or clean renewable energy. Where you just, you know, you really challenge in many ways the not only the mainstream environmental movement, but in, to a certain degree even the environmental justice movement. I mean, the best example for us here in the Bus Riders Union here in Los Angeles, which we've been fighting for compressed natural gas buses, given that, you know, at one time the MTA had the largest diesel fleet in the country. It had close to 2,500 diesel buses that were, you know, essentially killing Black and Latino children here in Los Angeles. And so you raised a really important question about, yeah, clean fuel is let's say a cleaner fuel for the, you know, for health, but in fact the extraction of it has some you know crazy consequences for a lot of indigenous people. Talk to us about that.
Correct. Well, first let me open with a metaphor. You know, 400 years ago, we had black robes or Jesuit priests come into our communities, our indigenous communities, promising a better quality of life by changing the way we communicated with our Creator. Now, 400 years later, the dynamic has not changed. We have corporate CEOs in black suits coming into our communities, promising a better way of life through changing the relationship that we have with our Mother Earth by entering into the industrialization game. And so the point you bring up is what I talked about at this weekend's wonderful conference that the Bus Riders Union hosted and the Strategy Center hosted was the reality that, many of our environmental justice movement, mainstream environmental movement, failed to take into consideration or to factor in the disproportionate impacts that many of our indigenous nations are burdened with as a result of the emerging gas economy here in the United States. So I guess there's a couple of myths that my intention at the conference and here on the radio today that I wanted to try and dispel. You know, a lot of people look to natural gas as being, you know, the most least carbon intensive burning of all the fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. And so a lot of people see it as a transitionary fuel source to, you know, get ourselves off of this aging, unsustainable fossil fuel economy that America has been enslaved to for the last 100 years. The problem with looking at natural gas as a solution is the fact that, you know, where this gas is coming from. Yes, in our inner city communities, we have lessened the impacts of diesel contamination. You know, the asthma rates are astronomical in virtually every city center as a result of the auto-centered transit economy of America. And, you know, of course, where are the highways? They're typically beside inner city communities of color, Latino, Black, and Asian communities. However, one of the things that IEN is trying to do in our work and our outreach to our sister organizations that are doing environmental justice organizing is to raise the fact that, you know, when people buy into the gas argument, you know, like, for example, you know, compressed natural gas buses or natural gas-fired power plants, the cost factor in terms of social, economic, spiritual, and political impacts that this kind of extraction has on our native communities across North America, where they are rich in the natural gas resource, is not factored into the price that people in the inner cities pay for their cheap energy. And what I mean by that is when you take gas out of the ground, it is still just as environmentally impacting as any other kind of oil extraction operations. There's still an incredible amount of waste that comes with it. And, of course, all of that, all of those costs are displaced on our communities where you have large amounts of gas extraction taking place in places, for example, like Montana, Wyoming, in the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow Territory, where a large majority of America's coal bed methane comes from. These people have seen their land fractured by thousands, literally thousands of gas wells all over their land, and they've seen, you know, the emergence of industrial roads to reach these different extraction sites, fragment their entire territory, and cut off their access, you know, to the traditional hunting lands. And this is the same story in virtually every area where you have gas extraction taking place. For example, like the San Juan Basin in the southwest, or up in the north slope of Alaska, where the U.S. is planning on building a large 800-mile pipeline to get the gas reserves of the north slope of Alaska down to market in the lower 48. And so I think what you see happening basically, and this has been the trend for the last 100 years of energy development in this country, is with America's emerging gas economy, you see the costs of the environmental destruction associated with the extraction of this precious resource displaced on the backs of our indigenous peoples in our homelands, just to service the unsustainable consumption needs of unsustainable cities. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I guess what the message that I'm bringing forward is that we really need to carefully look at the state of the movement and look at the need for some more cohesion in the movement on these issues of energy, because of the fact that indigenous peoples reject the concept that our lands that we rely upon to meet our physical, cultural, spiritual, and economic means being viewed as a short-term solution to offset the U.S. energy dilemma. Our culture should not be sacrificed for the high energy consumption needs of America's cities, bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's we're talking to Clayton Thomas Mueller with the Indigenous Environmental Network. No, you know, I think for us it was a huge eye-opener, and I think that was the importance of that convocation, was to have this type of dialogue, because I think it opened up, for at least for the Bus Riders Union Strategy Center, means we got to go back to the drawing board. You know, in other words, we do think that primacy has to be the needs of indigenous people, given, you know, 500 years is essentially of genocide that in many ways, you know, I'm assuming, well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, Mr. Bush Jr. And what has, is there been a heightened level of extraction and also the breaking of sovereignty of indigenous nations? Is that true, or is it, is not, is he doing any better than, you know, Clinton, or what's the deal here?
Well, you know, the last 4-year term that Bush had, every single year, Bush 2 was trying to push through probably the most pork-barreled energy bill we've ever seen, the Dick Cheney energy bill plan. is loaded with about $90 billion worth of giveaways to the fossil fuel, coal, oil and gas, and nuclear industries of America. This bill does not demonstrate in any means the political will that our government needs to display to moving towards an economy that is not dependent upon fossil fuels, or other harmful forms of energy such as nuclear. You know, bottom line, the situation on the ground in our homelands, you know, across Turtle Island is there's a direct threat to our sovereignty, to our quality of life as a result of the energy policies that this administration is trying to slam down the throats of our people. You know, bottom line, 2004, the oil and gas industry knows that we have reached pretty much the world's peak oil production. So they're scrambling to figure out how to prolong their life. Okay. Now, the way that they are going about doing that is that there is still about 50 years left worth of natural gas reserves so that America and its friends can continue to live their unsustainable, you know, lifestyle. What we're seeing happening now to, you know, further this advance is with this knowledge that there's 50 years plus of gas to sustain the fossil fuel economy, the energy industry has made its move to secure its grip on America's energy future. And the way that it's doing this is it's trying to get taxpayers and industry to invest in mega gas projects like the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline in Canada and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline in Alaska that promise to bring to market literally trillions of cubic feet of natural gas from the territory of the Gwech'en peoples, of the Inupiaq peoples living up in the North Slope of Alaska and Canada down to market because of the fact that it is a much more lucrative investment. They know they're going to make their money back. Just to give you some numbers, this, well, just one of these pipelines, if they go through, would cost in the realm of around $20 billion. Now, with $20 billion, we could purchase 12,500 one-gigawatt wind turbines, okay? And if you ask me, that is a much worthwhile investment than the building of a pipeline that's only going to last, that's only going to supply our energy dilemma in the lower 48 for the next, you know, 40 to 50 years at their current calculations. And so the energy bill that is about to emerge again, I've heard the term Franken bill because the same bill keeps coming back and we keep on organizing to kill it, is going to be rising up again. It's going to enter the House. And this bill basically is loaded with all kinds of giveaways that encourage that encourage the development, unsustainable energy development in our homelands, like more gas extraction, more uranium extraction, more oil extraction, and more coal extraction. And it does little to encourage, the investment that our taxpayers need to make in the development of a renewable energy economy here in the United States.
Well, you know, and talking about the last year's energy bill, one of the best stories you were talking about when you were talking about the energy bill last year, and one of the ways you were able to defeat it was, you know, historically in the indigenous movement, if you look at, you know, during the periods of the 70s, one moment of its height, there was, you know, a huge contradiction between, let's say, progressive, more sort of ecological-centered, more traditional, I don't know if that's the correct term, but more traditional groupings of a community versus, you know, a leadership at times who was sort of more catering toward the corporations and to the role of the United States. Can you talk to us about how one of the most interesting tactics you used to defeat the 2004 was to hit up some of the private native corporations that have been set up, right?
Yeah. Well, what basically last year's strategy and what a difficult battle that was, and I mean, I definitely sent shout outs to the many hundreds of NGOs that organized against last year's energy bill battle. The part that IEN did was basically our main concern was the Title V section of the U.S. energy bill, which focuses specifically on energy development in Indian countries, Indian country. Now, this particular section of the bill had language in it that proposed basically that the federal government would be alleviated of their sacred trust responsibility to tribes on matters of energy development in our homelands. And it also went further to basically give tribes sovereignty through tribal sovereignty, the right to do their own environmental enforcement. Now, this basically, in a nutshell, what it means is that tribes, you know, would be given the right to do their own environmental enforcement through tribal sovereignty, and this right would supersede critical legislation like the NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act, and the National Historical Preservation Act. Now, these two pieces of legislation are critical for the success of grassroots community organizers because they use we use these critical pieces of legislation to ensure that you know, harmful development doesn't directly threaten our sacred sites or our homelands. What this bill threatened to do, basically, under the guise of tribal sovereignty, was to put that right in the hands of our tribal governments, which in many cases, you know, unfortunately, are not necessarily on the same page as our traditional people that are still subsisting off the land, where, you know, a lot of our tribal governments are in support of large-scale extraction. And in particular, the Council of Energy Resource Tribes is very pro this because of the fact that many of our tribes do have the capacity to do their enforcement. But best case example of in terms of tribes that do not have that capacity is the Skull Valley Goshutes, who are being propositioned right now by the nuclear industries to support, you know, the storing of nuclear waste on their homelands. And so this is the case all across the country. There are some tribes that can do it and there are some that don't. And IEN definitely supports tribal sovereignty, but definitely right now, many of our tribes are not in a position to do their own enforcement. And, you know, this bill will, if the Title V passed as it is, would create a significant problem, I think, and give industries, you know, an unequal negotiating field with many of our tribes because many of our tribes don't have the capacity to negotiate with industry and ensure that, you know, fair and equal development agreements can be made. And that's where the government's trust obligation comes into play. Now, in Alaska, this bill also targeted Alaska Native corporations, which were created in 1971 through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which basically stripped away title of the land in Alaska from Alaska Native tribes and put it in the hands of for-profit corporations. Now, there are 13 of them across the state. And if this Title V was passed, what it would do would give recognition to Alaska Native corporations whose only purpose for existence is to generate revenue. And, of course, they do that through the extraction of oil, coal, you know, timber. It would give them recognition as Native tribes. In other words, they would have the right, on top of all of the development that they're doing, to apply for federal grants to subsidize their development schemes that they're doing up in the state of Alaska and further remove access and choice from Alaska Natives to kind of slow down the catastrophic development that has taken place in their homelands up in the state of Alaska over the last 35 years of oil and gas presence in that state. And so, you know, one of the things that IEN did last year was we went to America's oldest Native organization, which is the National Congress of American Indians, and we shared information with our tribal leaders about some of the harmful impacts of this energy legislation. And we managed to secure a letter from the National Congress of American Indians that got sent to Capitol Hill. To all of our senators opposing the current proposals in this energy bill because they would harm our Native peoples and our homelands. And lo and behold, Senator Inouye and Senator Akaka voted no against the U.S. energy bill, and it just so happened that we won by two votes last year in the Senate, and that's what killed it last year. So we did have a very successful experience last year. But again, the same threat is coming up this month at any time now. This bill is supposed to hit the floor again. And I have been told that it does include language that was not in last year's energy bill, which directly puts the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in the mix again.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, colonialism is such a monster and such so crazy of an ideology, right? Because here in California, you know, the Terminator Schwarzenegger governor here, he talks about, you know, he goes against sovereignty, but here you're flipping the script. where the federal government sort of wants to give sovereignty to a certain sector of the indigenous peoples, but mainly to extract more of the resources from the earth. And so, you know, it's like sovereignty is a very, like, lucid situation. In other words, like, you're only sovereign until their needs comes first, you know, the needs of sort of the white settler class that run this country. And so wow, it's just, you know, another colonialism 101, I think, is really good.
Yeah.
So, Clayton Thomas, why don't you talk to us about, you know, how people can get a hold of IEN and, you know, sort of what's the timeline here on this energy bill?
Well,
we got about 2 minutes, too, bro.
Again, it's all pretty vague information, and that's the way they like to do it, so that, you know, us people on the other side of the fence that are fighting against harmful legislation, you know, and harmful proposals, so that we have the least amount of time, I think, to prepare. They kind of wait to release language, but the bill is supposed to hit the floor in the next week or so. It's supposed to hit the floor of the House. Now, chances are we're not going to defeat this bill in the House because, of course, the Republicans have a House majority. However, I think our organizing opportunities come when this bill does hit the floor of the Senate, because we do have some people in there that will champion this issue, I believe. And one of the things that we do have on our side is last year, Senator Domenici and Senator Benjamin Nicehorse Campbell, one of America's only Native American senators, were championing this bill and trying to push it forward. This year, Benjamin Nicehorse Campbell, of course, is retired, and the new chair of the Indian Senate Energy House Committee is, of course, Senator McCain from Arizona, who is, you know, really thinking about climate change as of late, as we've seen through his McCain-Lieberman climate stewardship bill. So we've got, you know, that a couple of months of organizing time, and I think that, you know, people that want to get involved with
what's the email, Clayton?
It's www.ienearth.org. Again, that's www.ienearth.org.
I'd like to thank you, Clayton Thomas Mueller, with the Indigenous Environment Network. I'd also like to thank Dr. Richard Baker, our producer, Alan Minsky, our engineer, Ian Johnston. Today we had music by Aretha Franklin, Charles Mingus, and I'm hoping Silvio Rodriguez next. And so, signing off, my name is Manuel Criollo. This is Voices from the Frontlines. See you next week. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you are listening to Miles Davis right here.